Do they take him on or bend the knee? Europe's heard loud and clear that Donald Trump's fixing to force the continent to do much more than import liquefied natural gas pumped in the U.S. of A. We'll ask about the global implications of the new U.S. administration's scuttling multilateral efforts to cut the planet's carbon footprint, impose global standards on taxation, he doesn't like that, and regulate tech specifically.
Thank you.
The EU's efforts to rein in artificial intelligence. Instead, Trump launching a domestic AI infrastructure initiative that shows off how America's got, well, both the money and the cheap energy you need to power the digital transformation race. What does Europe have? We'll ask if leaders on this old continent have the collective power to defend their consensus-driven welfare state model and handle what's coming from the planet's most powerful nation these next 4 years. Today in the France 24 debate, can Europe meet the challenge this time? We don't know if he can see across the ocean from his perch in the Swiss Alps at the annual World Economic Forum. France 24's Charles Pellegrin joins us from Davos. Thanks for being with us.
Good evening, François. Thanks for having me.
For the art of the deal, look no further than digital diplomacy consultant Reina Stamboliska, CEO at RS Strategy. Happy New Year.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Happy New Year, bonne année, to energy consultant Philippe Chavez.
Bonne année to you.
Adrien Fabre is a researcher at the Public Environment and Development Research Body, CIRED. You're the author of A Global Climate Plan. Welcome to the... Oh, there you go. welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year.
You can, by the way, catch the catch-up version of France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. Ladies and gentlemen, the president of the European Council.
The time of comfort is over. We all know that. If today the president of the United States speaks about the need for Europe, for American allies to take greater responsibility for their own security, let's treat it as a positive challenge.
Treat it as a positive challenge. Now, Donald Tusk making that speech before the European Parliament because as of January the 1st, Poland has the rotating presidency of the European Council. He said something else in his speech, Reina Stamboliska, which is, yeah, Donald Trump's right. Allies should pay 5% of GDP for defense spending. We all have to boost our defense spending. It sounds a little bit, though, that he wasn't saying it for exactly the reasons that Donald Trump wants the 5% rule to be applied.
This is very true. I mean, everyone is expecting for the Trump presidency to bring about an end, or at least a sort of a resolution to the war in Ukraine. The question is, as usual, the devil is in the details. How will that pan out? So considering Trump's inability to remain coherent, at least for a lot of analysts and observers, the idea, and Poland is particularly well-positioned for this, the idea is for Europe to stop waiting for things to happen and perhaps maybe someday, you know, for better days to shine upon us, it is to say, look, we have this framework, we have this alliance, we have this agreement. We need to be masters of our own destiny, if you like, to foster our strategic economy and autonomy. And for doing this, well, we need to invest. Right. And Poland specifically is in a very, again, a particular position because it is one of the first and foremost destinations of Ukrainian refugees. It's been in a very, let's say, estranged, you know, best frenemy interaction with Russia. Now its agenda on for the Council of the EU, for the rotating EU presidency, is strategically geared towards, you know, bolstering EU strategic autonomy by fighting disinformation, by prioritizing cybersecurity, by continuing to promote the European agenda in the immediate neighborhood, Western Balkans, and so on. And so the question is, in light of this, the question is, how will we continue to hold the position that we have with this very, let's say, traditional foreign policy approaches vis-a-vis, well, hopefully an ally that is completely unpredictable and that has a very transactional style of deal-making, if you like,
and it harks back to a speech Emmanuel Macron made back in 2017 when he was first president at the Sorbonne University, where he talked very much along those lines. We'll hear from Macron, who spoke earlier in the day. But first, let's just give you a sample of what Europe's up against. Poland's prime minister, again, agreeing with Donald Trump that the EU needs to spend more, with the keen understanding that the continent can't forever rely on the U.S. going forward.
China's an abuser, but the European Union is very, very bad to us. They treat us very, very badly. They don't take our cars. They don't take our cars at all. They don't take our farm products, essentially. They don't take very much. We have a $350 billion deficit with the European Union. They treat us very, very badly. So they're going to be in for tariffs.
They're going to be in for tariffs. Charles Pellegrin, you've had now already a fair sample of European leaders come your way at Davos. You had, the German chancellor. This Wednesday, it was the Spanish prime minister. Are they saying we've seen this movie before, or are they nervous?
It seems like they definitely have a playbook for this already, considering their experience of the first Trump term. And whether it was Ursula von der Leyen or Olaf Scholz speaking on Tuesday, they both talked about having a pragmatic approach to their relations with the United States. And while still holding on to principles, notably the EU commitment to free trade, which is really built into the project of the European Union. The stakes are really high for European businesses here. I mean, last year, 2024, over 500 billion euros worth, dollars worth of European goods were exported to the United States. So they're eager not to see even a 10% tariff being slapped on those. So there starts the transaction with the United States. And the European Union also talking about hedging its bets, looking at other markets with which it could do business with, so it's not so reliant on the United States. Von der Leyen obviously touted its deal with Mercosur, the South American trade bloc, a deal that was extremely problematic and a source of a lot of conflict with France, which really underlines the difficulty for the European Union to come to any kind of a common position on how to deal with anything, really, and with Trump as well.
But as we heard in that clip, Donald Trump is going after Europe's farm products, its cars. In Donald Trump's world, trade deficits are what matter. Germany and France, well, they don't figure much on their own if you're the United States of America. But as a bloc of 27, well, the EU is the United States' top imports market above Mexico, China, and Canada. Those other two, Mexico and Canada, neighbors of the U.S. Phoebe Chavez, is this just all, you know, a bit of bargaining? Or is Trump 2.0 going to be very different when it comes to the European Union?
Yes, I think that we can speak a little bit about the fact that Donald Trump withdrew from the Paris Agreement.
Which is a sign to the EU as well when he does that.
Alors, it's a sign to the EU, absolutely. I think we can regret it. But finally, we can also think that he is a little bit right, because when we look in the back over the last 10 years, we can see that the decarbonation doesn't work. In fact, you remember that the Paris Agreement was to limit the global warming at 1.5 degree. And in fact, we reached 1.5 degree last year, because it has been published by the Copernicus European Institute.
So what's the answer then? Because you have the environmentalists talk about a climate emergency, and he declared an energy emergency instead and freed the hand of those who want to drill.
I think that, of course, the logic of economy has completely, I would say, go against the Paris Agreement. When you look today, especially at the rentability of green market, it's absolutely a disaster. Unfortunately, when you look at green project, I would say the return on investment are less than 5%, whereas...
Europe should instead invest in fossil fuels?
Oil and gas. No, there is no fossil fuel in Europe. But in fact, a company, European company, big European company like Shell, BP or Total Energy start again to reinvest a lot in fossil fuel. In fact, I think that the number of investment in fossil fuel for 2025 will be in the range of $1,250 billion, which means the highest second number after 2015. So there is unfortunately a reality, and I think that effectively it's a message to Europe that its Green Deal has to be reviewed. I think we have to put our pen on the table and think again what is the best energy
Adrien
transition.
Adrien Favre, if you can't beat him, join him.
Yeah, I don't know what you mean by putting a pen on the Green Deal. I think if the EU should do something in the next 5 years is really keep the Green Deal intact and strengthen it, actually, with more public investments, for example, for heat pumps, rechargeable stations for electric cars. And in general, the EU should also invest in its defense and on softwares, because I think the EU should take its independence from dangerous countries such as the US. The US cannot be considered as an ally anymore, and it's dangerous to be so dependent on companies like Google. To go back to the Paris Agreement, I think if it has been a failure, it's because negotiations at the UN seek universal agreements. So a few countries, namely the US, Russia, or Saudi Arabia, have always prevented any ambitious climate actions. The EU is undertaking ambitious climate actions at its level, but similar ambition is lacking in the rest of the world.
And to answer Charles, those investments now in solar panels, in electric vehicles, in smarter grids, will they pay dividends?
Yes, climate dividends. I mean, less warm climate.
At the end of the day, will it prove to be a smart move economically?
Of course. You know, the EU imports a lot of fossil fuels, and it costs European consumers to be dependent on their energy. If the EU decarbonizes, then it would be almost fully independent energetically, and the transition cost is high. But in the end, we would be much stronger without a reliance on the US or Saudi Arabia or Russia.
I'm sorry, but this is not true. It will not give the independence because all the solar panel, all the windmills, electrolyzer, hydrogen, everything is manufactured in Southeast Asia. We've tried to do it in Europe, but it doesn't work. I think that we can see from the beginning of the year that all the company are in very great difficulty. This is the case, for instance, for car. Manufacturers.
So that
Europe.
Point about deindustrialization,
we are completely killing the European economics with this stupid Green Deal.
What? No. I disagree on at least 2 points. First, if we decarbonize, we are energy independent because the solar panels, the wind panels, once you have installed them,
then the energy is free, contrary to fossil fuels, where you have to import them every year.
But you cannot rely only on renewables. It's not possible. Well, you can.
I mean, there are hundreds of studies showing how you can rely only on renewables. And I'm not saying we should only use renewables. There are also nuclear the thing is, I mean, are you seriously saying that we should forget about climate change and forget about the climate target and repeal the Green Deal?
I really think that we have to decrease the investment in decarbonation and invest much more on adaptation.
A different tack is that taken by France's president. He hosted his German counterpart this Wednesday to celebrate the anniversary of the Élysée Treaty of 1962 that binds the ties between neighbors and former foes. And for him, it's Europe has to invest more in areas where it no longer produces stuff, not just defense.
It is urgent for us to support critical industries such as automobiles, steel, and chemicals. There's also an urgent need to invest in key sectors: artificial intelligence, quantum technologies, biotech, energy, space, and of course the European defense industry. It's a matter of urgency that we use all European instruments to make sure that our companies and farmers have fair competition conditions in a world that is more brutal and uninhibited.
Brutal and uninhibited. Of course, that is a reference, I take it, a reference to the occupant of the White House.
It very much can be. It's what is quite, I would say, funny, but it's not funny. It's interesting to observe is all the euphemisms that have been around, take it from von der Leyen, take it from Donald Tusk, take it from Macron, from like everyone who has to have to take a position on the new US presidency, with, you know, none of them has been frontally going and saying, like, look, we cannot trust our oldest ally anymore, so we have to do things differently. No.
You think Macron should have been more forceful in his remarks?
Well, you know, it's... That's why I insisted earlier on...
Because he didn't name and shame there.
No, but none will, and that's... And that's a political choice. That's, if you like, a diplomatic choice, right? And the... That's why I insisted earlier on Tusk's and the role of Poland now. It's because at some point you are in a make or break situation. You have to have the spinal cord to say, look, there are things we are not going to give up. There are attitudes and approaches we are not going to take anymore. Swallow them and just turn the other cheek, you know? So the question is, who will say that? And will we say it individually as countries? Will France be the, you know, the usual contrarian in the crowd? Or will we say it as 27 countries under, you know, a EU very political presidency and commission presidency? Because Madame von der Leyen, she's an extremely political person. So whenever she says things, it's not between the lines that you're reading. It's like six, you know, you're drilling into. So the overtures she was making at Davos were towards China, you know, which means a lot of things.
Right.
Right. And we were discussing, I was observing...
Was she speaking in her own name or in the name of Europe?
No, she's not speaking in her own name, but she...
Of the Commission.
She speaks in the name of the Commission, obviously, but also she comes with baggage in the sense of... She's from CDU, she's from the European Parliament's majority party, which is the right, you know, EPP. So
as is Donald Tusk.
As is Tusk. And we've been talking about vehicles, decarbonation and things like this. Germany has a very clear and known dependency on EV, you know, in electric vehicles from China. It's Germany's global trade balance. So I'm talking under your control here, you know, in terms of economy and trade balance and things like this. But it's clearly economically not agnostic, if you like, of China. So there are also things which will always be there, which will always be internal policy vis-a-vis more global policy. And this is also what we'll see with Trump, where we can anticipate things from Project 2025, from his campaign promises and things like this. But, for example, on international cooperation or economic policy more broadly, in general, it's a wait and see right now, right?
Charles Pellegrin, we heard where you are in Davos on Tuesday, Belgium's outgoing Prime Minister Alexander De Croo saying the big winner of this showdown between Donald Trump and the European Union is going to be China. Listening to Reyna, how did Ursula von der Leyen's speech go down where you are?
It went down quite well. I mean, obviously, within the business community, there's a lot of support to maintain or stabilize relations with China because of the market it represents, because it's the second largest economy in the world, and obviously we saw that with the whole saga over the electric vehicle subsidy probe, where the European Union accused China of unfairly having an unfair competitive advantage on it. On its European adversaries in the EV space because of public subsidies, and there was a split within the European Union countries with Germany and the car manufacturers there with deep ties to China, both as a market and as a manufacturing base, and other countries like France that were more in favor of slapping tariffs. And so, in terms of how it was received here, I think the business community will always want better relations with China. Because of the economic powerhouse that it is.
Now, if you want to have Donald Trump's ear, it pays to be a billionaire. You even get to sit behind Barack Obama at the inauguration. Like, for instance, French luxury goods magnate Bernard Arnault, two of the Louis Vuitton Moet Hennessy's boss's offsprings, also with him in that row behind those former presidents. Last time around, by the way, French champagne, I don't know if it's Arnault, it was magic or not, escaped 25% tariffs. Other wines and spirits weren't so lucky, as Laurent Berstecker reports.
Hi, Keith.
On the day of Donald Trump's inauguration, Julien Noël is on the phone with his American clients.
Today is the great day for some people in America, but definitely not for the French wines.
This Bordeaux-based winemaker, who exports around 25% of his production across the Atlantic, fears the reinstatement of U.S. tariffs could severely impact his business.
We're worried because this represents 25% of Bordeaux wine sales, and we'll need to reposition that market. It's really bad timing considering the current economic climate.
During his first stint as president, Trump imposed a 25% surtax on French wines as part of an ongoing trade war with Europe and China.
So France did that. I told him, I said, don't do it, because if you do it, I'm going to tax your wine, tariff.
The tariffs were eventually lifted by Joe Biden, but not before wreaking havoc on France's wine industry. And while it hasn't yet been confirmed, Trump's recent threats to reinstate tariffs of up to 20% on all European imports has French wine producers fretting over the future.
At the time when China is struggling to get back on its feet, and with Europe quietly slipping to recession, it would be extremely painful for the industry if these taxes were implemented.
Donald Trump's protectionist policies could also negatively impact the cost and availability of French wine in the U.S. Fearing shortages and price hikes, many Americans already began stocking up on European imports like cheese and wine in November, just after Trump's election.
And there has been front-loading of champagne as well, according to reports in French satirical weekly Le Canard Enchaîné. They're going to accuse us of crying over spilt wine, Philippe Chalais here at France 24. But, it's a window into that uncertainty that lots of sectors are feeling right now.
No, I think that we need absolutely reciprocity to that. We have proposed with Nicolas Meillant, you know very well, that we could implement worldwide a tax at the importation in Europe on all the country producing more of a certain amount of coal, because coal is today the principal source of greenhouse gas emission. So we have in fact proposed to impose a tax equal to the percentage of coal in the energy mix, approximately. And it's interesting because the two numbers, for United States it would be 20%, because they have approximately 20% coal, and China is 60%. It's exactly the number, probably it's hazard, but it's exactly the number that Trump proposed to impose, 20% to Europe and 60% to China.
That's one idea. How do you deal with these threats of tariffs?
And
what about, let me just ask, let me ask Charles Pellegrin this. What about when we see Bernard Arnault there? Trump likes billionaires. Having these kinds of billionaires who are the people who have his ear, it seems. Is that obviously a topic of conversation where you are?
Absolutely. I spoke to a business executive who works for one of the big consultancies, the top four consultancies in the world. And actually, the prospect of seeing, 13 billionaires slated to be part of the Trump administration was actually a motive of maybe optimism in terms of their business savvy, in terms of their potentially being able to think outside the box and not being bureaucrats or politicians made in the mold in Washington. So there is a view that potentially some good things could come out of that administration because of all the billionaires in there. But obviously there are also many different voices here. I mean, speaking to Oxfam, saying that a lot of these billionaires perpetuate the myth that they've managed to earn the money that they make when they most of the time have inherited it, and all they're doing at this moment is just accumulating it and doing everything they can to protect it by buying political power. So not a big surprise to see Bernard Arnault at the inauguration on Monday, especially potentially trying to get a word in there about those potential tariffs on European goods entering the United States.
Yeah, and by the way, a cabinet stacked with billionaires, a drill baby drill mantra, that's fueling the concerns of not just the charity Oxfam that you mentioned, but environmentalists like Greenpeace. Their activists strapped a fictitious a ball and chain to the private jets used to ferry the high and mighty into Davos. They held an action this Wednesday. Reina Stambulia, this Gatsby age, if you will. There you see that ball and chain. This Gatsby age that we're living in with the private jets and all of that. How do you deal with it? And why are we living in this era?
Look, you have so many changes and digital at large, like technology. I'm not naming names and, saying that one or that one. But technology is changing the tissue, the social economic tissue and dependencies. And whenever you have that sort of shakeups, and each industrial revolution, if you want me to say the word, what you have is redistribution of power, right? Of power structures. That's what happened when Mr. Ford brought the assembly chain, and that's also what propelled things like Walmart, right? So you have a redistribution of wealth, and then you have a redistribution of power. So that's what we're looking at, here. But this is, to me, I mean, it's stunning but not surprising in the sense that you have someone whose ideology is transactional and deal-making.
And fascist.
This is my next point. But so it is absolutely obvious that in that line of thought, he will surround himself with people who are supposedly good at deal making, right? Then you have something else, which is, let's say, the ideology that is behind it, which, without going into like some crazy things, what we are seeing is authoritarian, dictatorial tyranny thing coming up. We're seeing plutocracy, if you like, where the power is remains with a few people who happen to have a lot of money, and where what is promoted is nothing short of things that we have seen in dystopian movies or in history books at a very dark time of history, meaning the 30s in Europe and so on. So what we are seeing is, let's go and get berserk on everyone vulnerable. Let's suppress reproductive rights. Let's suppress the right to decide one's own gender, meaning having control over one's own body, and so many other despicably and horrifying things. Let's remove migrants. You know, that sort of fortress US, in a way, policy. That has been there with no surprise. That's why I'm saying it's not surprising. It's been there. It's written on paper in Project 2025, which is nothing short of a program, a very meticulous program, to just completely untie everything that ties people together, and to also have everything that still has a semblance of functioning administration go in a totally different way, which is political allegiance to whoever is in power.
And, right? to the private sector. European energy companies that invested in the U.S. are reviewing their forecasts and growth expectations after Donald Trump pulled the plug on all new Biden-era green energy spending. Instead, Tuesday, unveiling a $500 billion artificial intelligence project dubbed Stargate. This in the company of tech titans that included ChatGPT boss Sam Altman and Oracle's Larry Ellison.
AI holds incredible promise for all of us, for every American. We've actually been working with OpenAI for a while and with Masa for a while. The data centers are actually under construction. The first of them are under construction in Texas. Each building's a 500,000 square feet. There are 10 buildings currently currently being built, but that will expand to 20.
See, America, it's got the space, it's got the cheap energy, and it's got the money. What's Europe's answer to that?
Well, let's talk about what we need to do. I think with the election of Trump, the rest of the world can stop being naive and understand that the U.S. cannot be an ally. Actually, in the last decades, the U.S. have blocked any international cooperation on climate, on taxation. Anything that would have made the world a fairer place has been prevented by big businesses, by billionaires, and by the U.S. administration.
So this announcement on AI.
Let me go on.
Right.
So we need to rethink geopolitics and build a coalition of like-minded people who want a fair and sustainable world. How to do that? Well, we can seek allies in Brazil in next year at the COP, in Africa, China, India, like basically global South countries and like-minded global North countries. And how would we do that? Well, the UN has recently created a new framework convention on international tax cooperation led by Africa. And there we can decide a tax on the richest, on profits at the global level, on digital ads. Mm-hmm. With this, we can invest in sustainable transition all over the world, fairly sharing the revenues across countries. This would tremendously help African countries, South Asian countries to develop. They would then like Europe, which would be one of the leader on this new geopolitical front. And it's only with such coalitions that we can meaningfully fight fascism that is spreading all over the world and that is really destroying our planet.
All right, but let me ask you then, because next month in Paris, there's going to be a summit on artificial intelligence, one that will feature some people, including Sam Altman, who was in the frame there in those images, but also world leaders like India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi. But what can an AI summit do if the United States government stays away or send or decides not to cooperate?
Nothing.
Yes and no. I mean, the question is, Europe, the EU is already the regulatory powerhouse of the world, if you like, right? The question is, will it remain like this and say, look, you don't like it? Those are our rules. You know, stop whining and you just respect our laws. So that's why I was talking about spinal cord earlier. You know, we have the AI Act, which is a landmark legislation. I mean, I can talk to you for hours about how complicated it is to interpret it, whatever. That's not the point. The point is that we need common rules to abide by. And because the question is, will we say, if you don't play by rules that others decide to play by, China mimicked GDPR
in the past
when GDPR
week, Reina,
happened.
How many times just have you heard? How many times have you heard the complaint? Why don't we have our own AI and giants? So, why don't we have our own tech titans?
The question is not there. The question is that you have an interdependence on so many things, and again, you need, excuse my French, but the frigging spinal cord to say, look, we decide that we will relocalize specific industries, that we will not allow US companies like X, Twitter, which does not respect our laws, to operate on our continent. End of story. You don't like it, you go away. If you like it, you stay here and we can talk. So there is also that sort of questions. It's Trump is whining that, yeah, you know, Europe is very bad towards us, excuse me. And so we're supposed to obey in advance and say, excuse me, Mr. Trump, here is, you know, yet another gift for you. So the question of cooperation is, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. We have a situation where that is at least somehow balanced, right? So do we accept to put our money where our mouth is, or do we decide to sit there and wait for things to happen and perhaps someday maybe someone will magnanimously grace things upon us, perhaps?
We heard earlier, Charles Pellegrin, and you could catch it on our website, your interview with one of the top execs at the networking site LinkedIn, and this whole question of what AI is going to disrupt further in terms of what jobs we have going forward, of and of who will create the global rules for this. I suppose it's front and center, at least in the discussions. But when you scratch the veneer in Davos, is it still a club for people who just, well, are in awe of billionaires, and if they're tech bros, so be it?
There's a lot of variety in the voices that we hear here. You know, I obviously mentioned Oxfam, and there's always someone to pipe up and to sort of give a dissenting opinion. And when it comes to the regulatory framework for AI, that's a clear discussion point. There's been a number of panels specifically about that. And there's a bit of a tension there between the need to try and find a common framework from very disparate positions, whether you're looking at the United States and Europe, and obviously Europe tends to have a stricter touch on regulation, but then also having to deal with a country like China, which you know, inbuilt in its rules to develop AI that algorithms should in effect respect traditional socialist core values. So how do you get a common framework through all that? And so there's a lot of discussions on that topic in Davos right now, and you know, we're still in the process of figuring these things out. But one thing that people here know for sure is that artificial intelligence and its implementation in business processes and all kinds of processes is going to happen. So we have to find a way to make it work.
So as you heard there from Charles Pellegrin, there's the American way, the Chinese way. Can there be a European way when it comes to AI?
I would say especially to answer to Adrian, because I'm, of course, in complete disagreement with you. First of all, remember that United States is a democracy, and all the other, of course.
Look at their electoral campaign rules.
Yes, of course.
It's probably
one at a time. Philippe Chalas.
Democracy in the world. And all the country you mentioned, first of all, they are already associated in what we call the BRICS, and they don't want the European Union or Europe to integrate them.
On Chinese negotiators, they are in favor of what I propose.
Don't forget that all these countries.
So can there be a European way when it comes to
China and all the African countries are still dictators? So I prefer, effectively, to negotiate with the United States than to associate with dictator. I'm sorry.
You will not obtain anything from the US.
And you will not obtain anything from China.
No, it's wrong. China agrees with that.
You are a great, great dreamer, but it's your right.
Reina Stamboli.
Yeah, I'm trying to save the people, you know, poor people. Contrary to Trump.
With China, you will say,
who will save the people?
The worst
affected by Trump policies, it's American themselves. Great. You know, tariffs, they will be very detrimental to US consumers. They will pay the cost. And who will win? The richest Americans. Because Trump will cut taxes on the rich.
And the richest Chinese, don't forget.
So we come back, Reina, full circle before the show ends.
Yeah.
Those lofty goals put forth by the Prime Minister of Poland, the President of France at the beginning of the show. Mm-hmm. We heard those clips. When it comes to concretely things like AI, can Europe forge its own way?
It's
realistically.
Yes, it's doing it. The question is, will it hold the line, right? It's not a question of if I come in and say, look, I want to lose weight today and only today, I'm going on soup diet all day. What is your answer? That's great. It's great determination, but one day is not enough. Can you hold the line for a week, for a month? And if tomorrow your partner comes home with those wonderful Parisian pastries, can you still hold the line? If I'm like, oh, no, look, today, our agreement is for today only. For tomorrow, I'm getting back to burgers, pastries and stuff, but I just want it to work magically. What's your answer? Please hold the line. Otherwise, no pain, no gain. You know, so that's where things are, is we are having good debuts on so many things, but we do need international frameworks where we can discuss with other people, because you can't do governance that takes care, and even without talking about care, that minds other actors while only doing bilateral stuff. And this is what Trump has been doing even during the first term. You take the space law, the Artemis Accords. That's what it's all been about. I can negotiate or bully poor people and countries into agreeing to my stuff, provided it benefits me.
Mm.
That's why he's been circumventing the UN and that sort of platforms. So the question is, can you hold the line? Can you just do one day? Can you do 1 week? Can you continue convening people and reconvening people and calling out inconsistencies? Because I'm sorry, but the sanitized, responsible AI everyone has been bragging about, you cannot tell me that for ChatGPT to summarize an email, it's melting an iceberg, and then come along and tell me, look, I'm a nonprofit, and I'm doing responsible AI. That's just not true. But if you're not calling out the inconsistencies there, and if you're not holding your ground,
it takes hard work, and it's for over the long haul. In any case, the answer.
Right.
Reina Stamboli, I want to thank you. I want to thank as well Philippe Chalas, Adrien Fabre, Charles Pellegrin in Davos. Charles, no private jets when you come back to Paris, please. I want to thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.